Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Pulley. I'm here with Tom Stura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of July 15th, 2024. So I was going to start on, I thought it was an interesting article in general, just the topic and kind of the, direction that it kind of provided. But it was an Info Security Magazine article, and it's titled CISA Urges Software Makers to Eliminate OS Command Injection Vulnerabilities. One, I thought it was interesting because it's just an interesting concept to say, let's eliminate vulnerabilities. But I think they do a pretty good job describing why they think they can actually get a better handle on some of these vulnerabilities and why these vulnerabilities have been really impactful historically. So that's why they really want to see if they can address these or hold these software vendors more accountable. But basically the OS vulnerabilities or command injection is a way where if there's any type of user input to anything, there's always a chance for manipulation if the inputs aren't being sanitized, scrubbed, or whatever, right? I thought this was interesting that they just picked on that specific class of vulnerability because I feel like SQL injection is kind of the same thing, right? A lot of times. But I don't think it's tied to the same major events like the Avanti products with, you know, or the Palo Alto Edge network products. But basically, what drove a lot of this conversation, I think, is there's a lot of major vendors and network stacks where they have edge devices that have these vulnerabilities, which make it really tough to defend an environment when your edge is kind of open to something like that. Or people are basically able to run OS commands on the underlying architecture there and potentially we're doing remote code execution of maybe other payloads and things. So they kind of talk about, you know, what will be the roadmap for elimination. And I talked about the sanitations, but I mean, it really is kind of very meticulous, but I also thought this is a great use case, I think, for a lot of, like, we talk about AI and where to use AI, not necessarily to solve the problem, but to put the toolkit for, hey, if you want to try to address this vulnerability in your source code, who's to say you can't push your source code through the language model and say, hey, are there any instances where there is user input? And is there, does it appear that there's any sanitizing constraints around it? Or do the sanitizing constraints not seem to constrain enough, like some level of that there? I thought that would be an interesting way forward as not a solution, but right, a tool to maybe help people address this initiative. So like I said, interesting approach, interesting ideas. Kind of curious what you thought when you kind of saw this, Tom.
Yeah, a couple things. You know, it brought to mind first, like the approach of, or the thought of, you know, the lack of security testing and how, you know, that's something that needs to be brought to the forefront, right? As the software is developed or these devices are developed and pushed out, you know, are they going through some level of that? And it seems like that's what CISA is really trying to push for. And that, you know, I've had some experience in that where you'd see where there's a critical device that really has like a very specific function. And maybe that function is very specific and critical for operations. And you do some level of advanced security testing on it and you find some of the simplest holes, some of the simplest things that were missed. And it's likely, you know, it's not necessarily negligence. My perspective, it's more that the focus of building what the device is or the product is just doesn't think about that because it's so heavy focused on its operations. Another point that I took out of this too, and I think it's interesting, is the growing voice that CISA's having. And more them kind of getting involved with this and trying to take a bit of initiative to, you know, round up industry and say, hey, let's sign this agreement. Let's all band together to say we're going to try to do a better job, right? Just kind of right. try to bring it out in the open, try to make it more of a thing for people to focus on. So those are a couple like big takeaways I had from that.
No, I think your point about, you know, the people building these things, it's not really negligence. They kind of have a purpose of why they're building it, and that's where their efforts and time are going. Kind of makes me think too, you know, cybersecurity is a great domain that is very siloed or segmented based on roles and responsibilities, right? Because I feel like it's so big too, that if you put one person in charge of everything, they're liable to have gaps and failures, because it's just a big undertaking in general. So I think, when you think about like roles and responsibility and pushing these products and reviewing these products, you can't just rely on, well, we have really smart coders that are going to, you're going to catch all these things, right? So having the right processes in place or the right resources available, or, maybe you just, you know, you find ways to just try new things that you think will address the problem just to change things up a little bit. But yeah, so brief, short, but I thought it was interesting to see this kind of movement, right? Especially for something that I agree there, I hate when they say that it's entirely preventable, as they put in quotes, right? Because that's like, you're setting yourself up for failure, because this one's like, I thought you said this was preventable. And you're like, we can really do a good job addressing the overall problem. Like, but
you gotta like the confidence though, right? You gotta like that confidence.
Yeah. Right. Charge. Right. Yeah. So yeah, what do you got?
Let's see here. So we'll jump in. First one I have, is an article from Hacker News. It's titled 10,000 Victims a Day, Info Stealer Garden of Low Hanging Fruit. You know, kind of walking through why I thought this was interesting is, this article discusses InfoStealer malware as a whole and how easy it is in today's day and age to kind of gain access to both the stolen data as well as the tools and the toolkits developed by the bad actors to, you know, kind of do what you want with. You know, a lot of it's due to that ever-growing big business framework model on the, you know, on the dark side of the web. And, you know, the days of just actor groups developing a full tool set that was proprietary to just that actor group with specific purposes and very locked down, those are kind of going away faster and faster. And you see that business framework becoming more modular and more monetized. And this article talks a lot about that. And it kind of continues to expand what the threats are too with this. So the tool sets, you know, they're being available for smaller dollar amounts. So someone may only need to come to the table with one specific know-how. They might just know how to write code in a specific way and relatively cheaply, and seeming to increasingly, costs are increasingly coming down because of the way this framework's developing. They can package together a whole thing with just that one skill set. Like an example, a soft example, you could develop your own malware loader, a dropper, but maybe you're not sure how to properly compile it to avoid specific AVs depending on your target. So you can go out on, you know, on a specific site. Some of the examples were in this article. $15 get you a compile for what you're looking for, and give you a 2-hour window to go out and test it, and even recompile it if you need to adjust something. You know, things like this are just, you know, rapidly building and increasing. I thought this article pointed them out a lot. There's a couple other things too. You know, maybe you just want to gain access to a specific target. There's sites out there now, like the Russian marketplace, $10. Get you what you need. Some really cool data points. I'm a stats guy, so I think these speak volumes to this topic. You know, as of 7/13/24, just over 7.2 million records were up for sale on this site. So you know, you can put these couple things together, and the barriers for entry for anyone, they're greatly reduced. So that's making the access to this tool, or the tooling, a lot wider. So it's not just threat actor groups, you know, it's everything between threat actor groups and script kiddies now, because it's making everything more accessible. So the attack, the threat, and the avenues those threats are coming from are just expanding. Just a couple more and I'll toss it to you, Scott, but I love these stats because they were kind of eye-opening. This is one of the things that got me the most from this. So the article reports some pretty insane numbers. I believe they were reported via hacktlist.io. So in the last 4 years, over 45.7 million identified infected devices, where 15.8 plus million had at least one set of credentials included in that data leak. And then they have in total that they have identified more than 553 million URL, username, password combinations, and infected devices spanning 183 countries. And they're identifying more than 10,000 victims per day. Those numbers were insane to me, and it's screaming to kind of like, you know, the expansion of the bad actor side and, you know, the need to really start talking more about understanding attack surfaces and exposure, you know, shameless plug, Intel 471, great job doing, you know, they do great jobs in that area. You know, you go into, you know, just stepping back to the article, you talked about the vulnerabilities, you know, some security best practices like vulnerability management. And then, you know, beyond that, thinking more from a threat hunting perspective to get yourself out there in your environment, identify these things before they find their way to the dark web to be sold or leveraged or added to a future tool set. I'll take a breath, Scott. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, I mean, so as a whole, it kind of just made me sit back and think about like the ebbs and flow of like what attackers do, what defenders do. And I feel like if you were to like open up and look historically, right, there was a big surge at certain times where people were looking for just pretty much using vulnerabilities and getting access to the environment first before getting credentials, right? That was like a common, you know, when you look at a lot of breach reports of things, that was a common element. So it was really about the social engineering to get in, and then credentials will be figured out later. And now it's like a different approach because there no longer is that perimeter that you have to break through anymore, right? When we think about how is IT and how is infrastructure set up, you know, you have SaaS for so many things, you have hybrid environments, you have like basically an infinite edge that no one's really protecting the same way. So being able to land in someone's home environment from like a work from home presence, and they manage their passwords with a browser to get into all these different SaaS type things or whatever. Now that's more it's clear because the adversaries realize this, that's more of a better approach than trying to figure out how to reverse engineer some sort of software or hardware to break into these environments. And people don't protect their passwords consistently yet. And it's funny because we also say passwords are like one of the weakest parts of security, right? But I also feel when we stand up infrastructure that people need to work in, operate in, if it's protected by a password, we feel more comfortable exposing it. But there's a lot of solutions that provide conditional access, right? And I feel like conditional access in a lot of the big breaches too, where people gain access, is not being leveraged, right? Where, you know, there is a lot, like, you know, you look at Azure environment, for instance. You know, I'm not savvy with every environment, but, you know, I've at least seen some of the controls around there. And you can just set up, especially if there's some sort of critical application or application you don't want to, you know, you want to put more controls around, you can make it to where if someone's never connected from that IP before, or that IP is in a different geolocation, you know, there's a lot of different criteria that you can put around that. Or even timeframes where, okay, they haven't connected in so much time. Now they have to do extra authentication steps to prove what they are. So the password becomes only a piece of it, right? And I feel like that is where, I mean, we said two-factor is a great thing, but obviously we can beat a lot of these different steps depending on, you know, how they're implemented, the determination, a lot of different factors. But I really feel like conditional access isn't leveraged enough. And that's why this market's growing, right? And what's tough is conditional access isn't something that is going to be implemented outside of an enterprise environment, right? Like if you want to connect to your Gmails or whatever, right? Like that's personal. There's not going to be a lot of that. But what's funny is I don't know if you've ever tried to log into something in a weird way where you'll get the email to say, should I even allow this? It's funny, like even they recognize the risks to where there is some conditional access being auto-deployed without your configuration in a lot of these aspects, but some companies aren't doing it themselves, making them vulnerable to these types of marketplaces and approaches. So I just think it's always interesting to look historically, right?
And that's a good, all that's a great point too. And it made me think about, and not to derail, because I think we could probably circle and go off on some whiteboards on this one, but you add the conditional access into, and then you have to be careful of those hurdles of kind of fatigue, maybe MFA fatigue, right? Where those can be exploited for additional gains. But
it's just interesting to see how I know that it's gonna be interesting to see what's next, if there's gonna be a net new next as far as where actors spend their time, or is it gonna be a cycle, right? So that's what I'm more interested in too, is like, well, what's to come if we address this problem well enough? Will they go back to what old tricks or new tricks? So.
my money is they're going to take the easiest route and always keep doing it as long as we allow it, right?
Yeah, agreed. So this next article gets a little more of the technical aspects of some of the things we talk about here. It is from McAfee, and it's called The Click Fix Deception, a Social Engineering Tactic to Deploy Malware. And this was just interesting, only because it's very similar to things you typically see in phishing, but it comes from, like, after the phishing happens, which is kind of, you know, when we're threat hunting, you know, we're really looking at almost like not initial but post activities a lot of times. And sometimes post can be like right after the initial access or initial run of things happens. But in this case, they basically saw a phishing attachment type of attack, and it was an HTML, so it made it look like, you know, it would take you, open up your browser, take you to basically a site that would look like Word, from what it looks like here. And then it would give you like a typical pop-up. You get Word when something doesn't run, almost like the macro trick, right, to get you to open macros. Except for since you're in a website, it gives you this thing that looks like a macro pop-up to enable, but it's like, oh, you don't have the browser extension to view this. Here, click this how to fix button, right? And by doing that, it actually causes an HTA file to be downloaded. But it's interesting because what it's running is it's running a command to basically start PowerShell. PowerShell is going to create an HTA file. It's going to do an invoke web request, which is a typical PowerShell download of that from whatever site that they want to pull it down from. It's a single character file, single character name file, which I always call out just because, yet again, something to just be aware of, right? It's not bad to just look to see what exists in your environment that happens. And then kicks that process off. So what I like about this is the output of that command that run, it's a one-liner, but there are so many behaviors and techniques in that one-liner that if you're just looking for one, you see the whole thing. And when you see the whole thing, it's very clear that it's probably not good, right? You see CMD starting PowerShell as a one-liner, which is always kind of suspect. You see the invoke web request, you know, PowerShell is doing the network pull-down stuff. Suspect. You see the single character thing, and then you have it starting a process. And then it does clear the clipboard. I've never really looked for that specifically from a behavior, just because I would never expect it to see it like persist in a command line. It'd be interesting to see it if you're looking at the PowerShell transcript, right? If you have those logging enabled. But in this case, you could hunt for that for this specific thing, and you would see that characteristic because it would be part of the command line based on how to execute it. That's what I think is the biggest thing that I kind of pulled out of this, just because it's really cool to see, hey, they had this really unique way to trick people, but under the hood, it's like how almost most things are always run, downloaded, and executed. So those behaviors just kind of just persist even though the attacks change. So that was a big piece. There wasn't a lot of other things. There are a couple other things. I did see that they leverage auto IT to run some things. And what's interesting about that in general is there's going to be great command line data when a tool like that's run, because it's basically doing single line executions of things like you would see in the batch script. So you might see more CMD or PowerShell command lining stuff happen within a short window. So it's easy to really, see that narrative or that story. And you may be able to do some things when you look at like, hey, do we have, you know, so many PowerShell executions or CMD executions within a short period of time, like a bunch of them, different process IDs, that could be indicative of something batch running something and using those scripting languages to do it. So that was another thing that kind of stood out. And you can even see there is just a ton of activity of PowerShell. They have some screenshots in the report that kind of, I think, replicate some of those things. But yeah, there's just some highlights. It's always kind of cool to see what security vendors pick up on it for the initial access and see how does threat hunting plug into that after the fact. So yeah, what did you think when you saw this one?
Yeah, no, the a couple things that first in my, like the first pass on it was more towards the psychology piece, because this was interesting. I haven't seen this one before where they kind of make you copy paste, like the Dark Gate reference where you click the fix now button inside of the fish, the inside of the Word doc, and it guides you step by step, you know, to launch a run dialogue and then just do a control V and paste it in their general user. They're going to do that, and it's going to pop something up that they've probably never seen before, in most users' case. And they're going to, you know, use hotkeys and maybe some that don't even completely understand how to use copy paste. And it's like the psychology part with that, as each step anchor the user in, right? So if they go to the point where they're opening up the run dialogue, they're embedded now. And as it moves and succeeds, they're just going to operate. It's just going to make it work so much smoother. But from a,
and as it works, that they feel more confident, right?
Like, they feel more confident, like, right? Yeah, yeah. Right. So then it, like, my security mindset makes me afraid of what's behind that door once it's opened, you know, like, oh man, the user's completely hooked now from a psychological standpoint. But then the other part too, when you look down in this article where it talks about another, nope, I lost my window. It talks about another versioning of this from the Luma Stealer, where the sample that they give here, it actually walks you down step by step of, you know, click copy, right click on the Windows icon, and then select Windows PowerShell admin. That had me thinking from like a practitioner standpoint of ways that you might be able to /detect things, of looking for, you know, it launched by admin in like in an environment, maybe in your own environment, if you're trying to understand what's going on. That would be, if you have, like Scott had mentioned, if you do have the logging enabled, that would be a pretty cool data dig to see who's launching PowerShell admin Windows, right? So that was the second part my brain went when I first did a pass through. But yeah.
Not only that, like I'm trying to remember what logging or telemetry is launched when you try to and you don't have admin rights. And I think something still gets logged. I just don't recall what it is. But you know,
yeah,
that's a good example. Yeah, but like that's something that, you know, as a threat hunter, when I think about those scenarios, that's why it's really cool to try to emulate some of those things. Okay, well, what does it work like? What does that look like? If you fail, what does that look like? Because you're hoping that this type of attack or these attacks, if they're hitting an environment that's managed, that not everyone has admin rights. So that would be a characteristic you could look at. And not only that, but that might, for like, you know, inside threats and things like that, that might be another good thing to just be looking for those behaviors where people are doing things just out of the ordinary that they
should. Out of the ordinary, right? Not typical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So cool. So what do you got for us next?
All right. So article we have here from a Juniper blog. It is discussing the Bianlian ransomware group. For those that might not have heard of this group, they're one of the top three most active in terms of posting victims' data. In 2024 alone, so far they've posted 90 victims on their site, ranking only behind Lockbit 3 and AlphaV. This group emerged in 2022. And in 2023, their decryptor was released, so it forced the group into that pivot to steal the extort model, so basically snatch and grab the data, and threaten to release it if the ransom isn't paid. They primarily leverage compromised RDP creds, remote desktop creds, and likely those creds are gained either from purchasing off, you know, off the dark web, what we discussed before, big business, there's a lot of data out there, or leveraging phishing campaigns to gain those. They've also been seen gaining initial access to vulnerabilities in ProxySell and SonicWall VPN devices. So they deploy their custom malware, and it's written in Go or Golang, including a custom backdoor that anchors in for persistence and additional exploitation. This is something that I did note is, at least from my perspective, and Scott, you can center me on this one because I only live in my little corner of the world, but you're seeing more and more and more people leveraging Go to build their malware. You know, the ease of use, the simplicity of it, users can write and compile code with less overhead, and it transfers pretty simply across multiple systems like Mac and Linux and Windows. But yeah, so reading down through this article before, you know, we get to the heavier technical side, this group does appear to be very opportunistic. So some of the stats that were listed inside of this Juniper article show that they basically touch on all industries. There's nobody that wasn't out of line for them. And you know, they're the heavy two, which weren't even that crazy high. They were in like the 20%, and 18% were healthcare and legal services. But they really did touch on every group. One of the points of this article that I did find very interesting. I'll take a breath, Scott. Do you have any thoughts before we dive into the technical side from just that perspective, or anything you might know about them that maybe I didn't speak on?
No, I think the big thing when I read this was really the call out to the shift to extortion. Because, you know, I think you're going to see if people get better and better at, like, you know, I've seen some people make claims and have tools that basically can interrupt the ransomware operation, as far as once ransomware code is deployed, they have endpoint type tools that apparently can disrupt the whole thing. Well, that's good and all, so you can protect yourself from ransomware, but people also have backups. So sometimes restoring from backups isn't too big of a hurdle for some companies, depending on the type of business they're involved in. So the extortion thing, I think, has become more prevalent as we get better dealing with ransomware as a whole, right? But the scary thing is not so much that this is a ransomware group and they extort people and they're able to ransom groups when they were successfully ransoming groups or victims. It's just the level of access. I mean, these groups, let's say we stop them from doing ransom, or we were able to get, you know, impede some of the extortion techniques with them exfilling data. There's not really people preventing these people or these groups from getting in, right? Which is like the bigger problem, because, you know, I always have to catch myself. I like to say the ransomware operators are not sophisticated compared to some of the other groups out there. But the thing is, it's not that they're not sophisticated. They're just really efficient, and they just use what works. Mm-hmm. So they don't need to be overly sophisticated. They're just really effective. And the things that they're effective with is the same things that a lot of them share, use, and utilize. And so I feel like if we really want to take a big hit out of the crime underground world for, you know, cybercrime things, it's that initial access piece or that lateral piece that we have to figure out, right? Maybe the initial access is too big, but the lateral piece should be easier to manage or should be. So that's like the big thing I kind of took away from here was, like, you know, just be like, here's a group that we took away their ability to do ransom, and it slowed them down, right? And so that speaks volumes as far as their operation and operationally, like, what that looks like. That was my biggest takeaway, was that this methodology piece. I don't know.
Thinking through that too, you know, I think the fact that the steal and extort model is more prevalent is more dangerous, and it's more dangerous because you're relying on the honorability of the thief to not expose what they have of yours. And there's, you know, use it not publicly. Right. Right. Like we've already talked about multiple times in just this last half hour of, you know, the ability and the access of data that's out there with some crazy numbers, and that's money for the bad guy. They're going to get it one way or another. And I think the extort model just makes it more dangerous, because now it can be used in a plethora of ways. And it's more widely open. You know, it's almost taunting. It's like, yeah, we got it. We're going to do what we got to do with it. So it's on you to try to solve it, you know? I think it was a very interesting article. It's something to watch for sure.
Cool. So I'm going to pivot to, it's a BlackBerry blog article, and it's called "The Coyote Banking Trojan Targets Latin American Markets with a Focus on Brazilian Financial Institutions." So this was interesting because, you know, when we talk about actor motivation, that's like a big driver for, you know, a lot of the activities we see, especially in the criminal cyber realm. And it basically is, there's some reporting they pulled together from like the World Economic Forum and stuff, where it says, you know, looking at Latin American countries, their markets are increasing. Like there's more money going through them. They're being more prevalent in the economic world, so to speak. But they are very, very high number of insufficient cyber resilient organizations that fall in there. So you think about like prime target landscape. So that was, it was interesting to see, like, you know, maybe you don't see a lot of news about, you know, things being hit or targeted there. We always see like, you know, big top name countries that are global name, like the United States, you know, key countries in Europe. And it's because there's usually money there, right? Or at least a good sizable amount of money makes it worth the time. Well, there, if there's other easier targets, then you can expect that to be, you know, that could change very easily. But in this case, what was also interesting was one of the Trojans, the things that they were basically hitting people with was a program or software called Squirrel that is not really malicious in general, but it's a software used to actually manage installations and updates to Windows applications. So, you know, I thought it was interesting, like, if you can make someone think that, hey, I want to make you more secure, and they have that sense of I'm doing the right thing, but it's really enabling them to get, you know, owned in this way. I thought that was, you know, my psychological, you mentioned that aspect earlier, interesting. And then also the use of NIM programming. This is probably the third time I've hit the article where NIM, which is kind of like a common language that you can, like, you kind of code across multiple platforms. You know, you mentioned Go is a very popular new, like, NIM seems to be another prevalent one that's kind of getting a lot more use for similar reasons. What was interesting about the infection vector too was the size of the Trojan. Like, you know, we're talking like 170 megabytes, I think someone have to download, which, you know, the benefit there from the attacker's perspective is most endpoint detection software is not going to scan that, right? File's too big, it's assumed is probably fine, and it doesn't want to create or impede anything to do with the system trying to, like, dive, you know, pull that thing apart. So that was some aspects of it that were interesting. If I remember correctly, yeah, it uses kind of a double DLL side loading. I didn't call it double DLL side loading, but basically Squirrel pulls in a non-malicious Google Chrome DLL. And that Google Chrome DLL is actually vulnerable to DLL side loading. And then it pulls in a malicious Chrome Elf DLL that's contained in that package, which I think is interesting because I wonder if that was intentional or just opportunistic. Like, I don't know, was that a way to where that they needed it to function that way to get around certain tooling or protective tooling, or if it's just, that's just how it worked. So I thought that was interesting. And I thought there was something to do with the persistence piece. Yeah, so the registry, right? Once they get their payload in there, they have, you know, they're executable. They're leveraging, you know, standard Windows persistence with registry. And this one they're using where it's the current user hive, environment, user init, NPR logon script. Basically, yeah, if you log in with that user, it's going to execute whatever is in that path. And that's their persistent mechanism. So, you know, I thought that was an easy thing to be, you know, on the lookout for in general. Anything that associated with logons or anything associated with auto run. Yeah, there's a lot of registry values or a lot of registry keys that are associated with that. That's a good thing to understand those lists. This is one of them. To be looking for, even if you miss any of the complicated stuff going into it, like, that's always a good place to start because you can usually walk that back. And what's nice is when they have startup scripts like that or things point to stuff to execute, now you know what payload is probably bad, and then you can find any telemetry around that payload or associated to it, then you kind of know what happened to before all that. So yeah, then they do a pretty good write-up on just, like, you know, the actual activity going on. As far as call outs, communications, and things like that, I usually don't find that so important personally. But a lot of those artifacts that we mentioned previously, or just even that one catch for just the auto run piece, I think is good enough to start finding this type of behavior if you're concerned about it, or honestly, similar behaviors because it's commonly used technique. So yeah, what were your takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, you hit on most of some of the stuff I had. You know, echoing the file size, that one stood out to me right away, for all the reasons you had said about it. You know, likely not being scanned, an easier way to be able to pull that down and deploy and evade detections. But you know, maybe you know, kind of thinking around this from an overview standpoint, it's interesting that the evolution of security, like kind of where we are in 2024, where, you know, this, if an attack surface arises, it's going to be exploited, especially if there's money involved. And it made me wonder, like, you know, in something I actually have noted to go kind of self-research, because I'm very, very interested in this, kind of nerded out on this idea, is what do the statistics maybe look like, if they're there, of, you know, how are companies considering that, you know, it not necessarily in, you know, maybe the bigger attack surface countries like the US or China or Russia, et cetera. But when you see, you know, up and coming countries getting more into this technical side and having more attack surface, more landscape, these big businesses that are deploying and growing countries, are they taking the lessons learned from those that came before them? You know, it's just wild how fast attack surfaces are accessed. Doesn't matter where you're at, or if you're popular, if you're net new, it was really cool to think about. And then it's a little off of where you were technically, but
I think one of the interesting points about what you bring up too is you talk about different parts of the world, and if they kind of hit the spotlight for, hey, there's an opportunity there. One thing that will be very interesting is social engineering will be very different, because social engineering is tied to people and culture. And so, you know, when you talk about the amount of investment that some security firms and people and enterprises focus on initial access pieces, like that's something that you run out of resources real quick. And it just shows that, like, you know, that one solution that might work really well for social engineering type stuff in one part of the world might not work in another part of the world very well, right? Because some of the techniques might be different enough. Which kind of
just drives a language barrier too, right? Like we see that all the time. Even in like basic phishing training, that language barrier is a good indicator of somebody just not knowing the natural flow of a specific language.
So you know, taking away from that, the one thing that is consistent are after that initial piece, right? And that's the one thing I like about MITRE. I don't think MITRE covers enough things when it comes to behaviors, but it's a finite list, right? Like you're talking like 410 items versus, you know, we just described how you add another regions to the world, you're adding hundreds to millions of different ways to try to get initial access through people alone. So some of the things we even talked about in other articles, kind of the same thing as far as how they're tricking people psychologically, getting them to do things. But yeah, so that part is kind of interesting. You kind of bring it up that way. I think that closes out our five big things we wanted to talk about. But before we close out, I have some mentions. We're coming to the end for the discounted rate for the training that's going to be offered at Black Hat if you're going into Black Hat this year in August. And it's going to be a beginner's guide to threat hunting. It is a training that was already presented last year, and it's going to be presented again this year. We got some good feedback on it last year, and this year, I'm sure there's going to be some additional things added, because as things change, we update. But that's going to end July 19th. So, you know, if you want to join that training, or you're able to get access to that training, register soon so you get the discounted rate. The other thing is we have the workshops that we usually put on happening at the end of the month, and this one's going to be Hunting for Command and Control, also done by Lee Arcanal. He's doing the Black Hat training as well, and Jorge Rodriguez, which is the director of malware here at 471, and that's going to be July 31st from noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, so definitely check that out. And if you don't have the time to actually see it live, definitely register so that it's easier to get to the recording so you can view it after that. So with that, I really just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. So that closes out the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of July 15th, 2024. Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.